Hi, I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, host of the Above Average Intelligence podcast here on the DSR Network. Every Monday, I speak with journalists, authors, and of course, actual former intelligence officers, spies like myself, for a look at current events from the perspective of the intelligence community. If that sounds good to you, then please consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Members of the DSR Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 for a year. As a thank you for listening, I'm offering 25% off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code Intel. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code Intel.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. Today, I am very happy to welcome as my guest, Christina Hilsberg. In fact, her second time on the podcast. We have some really important things to discuss today, but let me just give her a little bit of background. She's a former CIA intelligence officer. While at the CIA, she wrote analytic assessments for the president, his cabinet, other senior level policymakers. Christina specialized in African politics and leaders and was one of the IC's few Swahili and Zulu linguists. And I think actually that's pretty cool. I love when we kind of chat about that. She later worked in the CIA's Director of Operations, my old kind of tribe, clandestinely collecting intelligence from the field. She is the author of Licensed to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. I actually love that book, and I think you and I have talked about it quite a bit. And really, of kind of exciting news, she's the author of the forthcoming Agents of Change, The Women Who Transformed the CIA, which will be published in about a year from now, and we'll talk about the book later. But some really important things to discuss today about sexual harassment at the agency. This is going to be obviously a topic which is really important for the future of the organization, but also accountability for the past. One of the things that I wanted Christina to come on today is to be as honest as she can be on this issue, which I don't think has gotten enough discussion in the press. But first of all, Christina, welcome back to the show. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So before we talk about your book, and we certainly want to kind of go over that because I'm really excited about this. I think your book is going to add to a considerable body of work now about female officers in the CIA. But I think you have a unique perspective on this. Probably as one of the younger officers who are writing on this. And I think that's important. And your view of your time at the agency and what the agency has to do to transform. But we're going to start off with, as we always do, with kind of current events. And something happened last week when the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence released a report about sexual harassment. And I'm just going to read a couple kind of, I would say highlights, but it's not highlights. One note was the CIA has failed to handle allegations of sexual assault and harassment within its workforce in a professional and uniform manner, and appeared to mete out little to no accountability or punishment for perpetrators. You know, when I read that, obviously, I think that is pretty damning. It's also a pretty honest assessment. So as someone who has really followed this issue, and you've been kind of a leading advocate in terms of victims of sexual harassment at the agency and how the place should reform, I just want to get your kind of overall thoughts, and then we can kind of dive into the report as well. And again, I'm glad you came on because I don't think this is getting enough attention in the national security space now. So this is your chance over the next 40 minutes or so to kind of give us your honest thoughts. And I think the listeners will really benefit from that.
Well, you know, Mark, I totally agree that it's not getting enough coverage. It's shocking, really. Every time something happens with this issue, I think that it's going to be all over the news. I see the first couple articles trickle in. I've got a Google alert with some specific terms, you know, following this issue. And I think like, okay, now this is finally going to get on people's radars. But of course, we've got a lot of huge things going on in the world right now that are distracting people from this, for better or for worse. And so it's not really getting the coverage. So I'm thankful to have the opportunity to talk about it today. And I think seeing the committee's report last week it's not surprising to anyone like you or me that's familiar with the toxic environment and the numerous incidents that have occurred over the decades, but the ones that in particularly have come to light over the past 2 years. But seeing it in black and white, I think, is really powerful. I think it's going to hold the agency accountable, put their feet to the fire so that they really have to put their money where their mouth is, so to speak. But I do think that there's quite a bit of lip service. There were a few parts in the report that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, to be perfectly honest. You know, just kind of parts where they're giving credit to the agency for, you know, working well with them and they're open and they have this will to make the right choices. Because when you read that on the surface, you look at everything they've done, you could walk away from this thinking, wow, they're really trying to change, right? And maybe they are. And I don't doubt that there are some leaders there that really do think this is atrocious and want to do the right thing. Sure, they are there. But we are talking about a deeply rooted culture where this has been going on for so long, it's going to take so much more than that. And so what rubs me the wrong way in particular is when all this was going on and, you know, Director Burns was meeting with HPSI and being cooperative and all these things, we've simultaneously got this incident with Jane Doe, which I can go into the background on that, where they are doing the complete opposite of what they are saying they are doing. So, and I can go into that and talk a little bit about the background of Jane Doe. So this is the woman who was assaulted at headquarters in the stairwell in July 2022 by a fellow trainee. She went through reporting it to numerous offices at headquarters, did not receive the support that she needed. Her attacker was later convicted in Fairfax County court. He was not immediately fired from the agency for months. I understand that he's not there now. There hasn't been clarity from anyone on what exactly happened to cause him to leave, but he was around for months after that conviction. And it seemed that no matter who Jane Doe went to, she was not receiving the support, to the point that she later filed a lawsuit against the CIA for discouraging her, dissuading her from going to law enforcement, to the point of witness tampering. So all of this is going on. Meanwhile, she's cut from the farm and she's fired. And she should be protected by whistleblower retaliation. So it's like you've got this CIA cooperating, saying they're doing all the right things, setting up committees. But then when there's an actual whistleblower who has come forward and sacrificed her career, they view her as, in my opinion, a legal liability, and they want to get her out because she's a problem.
So I think, you know, you raise a very good point in that, you know, it seems to me that there is a lot of happy talk coming from the agency on this. Now, you know, obviously I worked there for 26 years, and there was a terrible kind of culture of harassment when I certainly first started. And what I saw over time was a lot of the more overt harassment was cleaned up. But actually, in some ways, and that's a good thing, let's just put that out there, but in some ways, it becomes even more insidious because you do have this still occurring, yet it's behind the scenes. And the only way to combat that is, frankly, if the agency can police itself. And to me, this report seems to suggest that it cannot. And so that's damaging. You know, what would you tell to kind of the next generation of, and let's just be frank here, of female candidates who want to come into the CIA? Is this a safe place, frankly, for women to serve? I mean, I think it's a pretty dramatic statement, but how do you not ask that question after seeing the results of this HPSI report?
Well, I think with the new standards and policies they're putting in place, it's probably will be the safest it's ever been, right? It's like, I remember years ago, bear with me, this is a crazy comparison, but do you remember when that person bungee jumping like over the Zambezi River in Africa, like the bungee cord broke and she was like in with the crocodiles with her like legs tied and she somehow survived, right? So after something like that, you're like, oh, I would never want to go do that. But that's actually probably the safest time to go bungee jumping there because they're putting all these like standards and policies in place to make sure people are safe. So even though this report is so damning, it's probably the safest time for women because finally people are doing something about it. Women have found ways to report. I mean, that's been one of the issues, is that there hasn't been a clarity over how exactly to confidentially report assaults. And so now these standards are being put in place. So it's probably the safest time for women. You know, that said, it would be easy, you know, when I think about my daughters, would I want my daughters to be there? It would be easy to say, no, like this is a horrible environment. But at the same time, and what I try to prove and demonstrate in my upcoming book that you mentioned is that we need women. Women are such a vital part of the mission. They bring abilities and talents that their male colleagues simply don't have. And to be losing women because of this environment would be a travesty. It would impact our national security in the most negative way. And so what we need is to encourage women. So what I hope by shining a light on some of this, particularly with some of the women I profile in my book, is that women and men will read this before going in and go in eyes wide open, know what the environment is, and that the agency will start providing some training so that people can recognize what's going on, understand what's acceptable and what's not, and where to go. And when they go to those offices, there should be a trained individual in place. And I think that's been some of the issues when Jane Doe was dealing with reporting her incident. The people that were in some of these offices had no training in like trauma victims and how to handle them. And just they completely bumbled the way that they handled this. And then the fact that her attacker was convicted and nothing was done about him for months. And again, I don't know whether he resigned or whether, you know, he was let go. Do not have those details. But she did tell me, and I interview her for the book, that it was like walking into a cage with her attacker every day. And the agency provided no security for her. She had paramilitary officer friends who would walk her to the cafeteria, who would walk her to the gym. The fact that she had to find people to keep her safe is absolutely unacceptable. So those are the things that I think are changing now. And so I hope that women will not be deterred from joining, because we need them and we need them to continue speaking up. And I think oftentimes we talk about, or you hear people talk about, like a sisterhood with the agency. I don't know that there's really ever been one for decades and decades. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. But I will say that the women who are speaking out and who have been sharing their stories with HPSI, there is a connection and there's a bond with a lot of these women, and there's a lot of support going on. People who are still there, current women and formers, I'm in the chats with them. The amount of women who've shared their stories with me, there's a lot of support right now.
Yeah, you raised something that's actually really, really interesting. And as someone who, you know, managed in the field, I will affirm this notion of not only the value of course, you know, diversity and having a diverse workforce, but in particular female officers. You know, it's not a secret, and I think there's others. I think of my friend John Cipher, who served in Moscow. But you know, in some of the harshest counterintelligence environments that we have, female officers handle actually the top cases. This is an unscientific statement, but it's just one based on my experience, and certainly in some of the locations where I served in the Middle East, we had female officers handling, for example, our top penetrations of the adversaries. Intelligence service. And so I think you're 100% right. For so many reasons, this is important, not just right and wrong, but also for national security. You know, one of the things that I found that was noteworthy is that 26 whistleblowers, according to this report, 26 whistleblowers came forward. And I go back to something, which again, coming from, you know, 26 years at the agency, people might find strange, but in the sense, I actually do believe in congressional oversight, because I don't think we can police ourselves. And so the fact that HPSI took this very seriously, you know, chatting with one member of Congress, who's a friend of mine, you know, Representative Abigail Spanberger, who's on HPSI, and she, of course, could not tell me anything about the investigation. But what she did say to me is that when she first learned of this, she was pissed. Again, former female case officer. And so, you know, we got to get this right, and we do need Congress's help. And so in this case, oversight, I think, was absolutely critical. One thing that I want to highlight, and perhaps, and you said you interviewed some of these officers, you know, it's not easy for a CIA officer, particularly active, serving, to go to Congress. So talk about what it was like for some of these whistleblowers to actually make that decision to come forward. It's legal. They can do this. But it's a pretty brave thing that they kind of go forth with. Certainly it's going to cause them, And I would dispute anyone who said this. It's going to cause some career issues with them. Yet they decided to do it. So talk about what that was like in speaking with some of the whistleblowers.
Absolutely. I mean, specifically Jane Doe, she was actually discouraged from going to HPSI. So she went, she shared her story with HPSI in January of 2023. The day that she was going down to the Hill, she received a call from OCA, Office of Congressional Affairs at the agency, telling her that she better not go. Like, if you leave this office, there's going to be a problem. And she went anyway, which I think is extremely brave. And, you know, her attorney has given some statements since this report came out last week and saying that, you know, she sacrificed her career so that this could take off and we could create an environment where women are able to share their stories. And so by her choosing to leave the building that day when she was deliberately told not to, I think was really the first step in kind of just kind of setting a chain reaction of women sharing their stories. And like you said, it's not easy to go and sit in a room that's full, you know, wall to wall of committee members who are there listening. That's a really intimidating experience. And to the committee's credit, I understand that they are very sensitive to these women who are reliving trauma by sharing their experiences. They don't push them to share anything they're not comfortable with sharing. But, you know, it is really brave and it's not easy to do. And especially when there's not the support existing and deliberate, you know, efforts to dissuade officers from going.
Does the agency hide behind kind of that veil of secrecy? I mean, it seems to me that the lack of accountability so often is because of that.
Yes, I think it's an easy crutch to lean on because we're worried about cover. Well, you know, you can't report this to law enforcement because that officer is undercover. So you can't give these details. You can't give this person's name. You're undercover. You're jeopardizing your career. And I think that there are so many women. It's interesting because, you know, the title of this report is related to like the agency's handling of sexual assault and harassment. Well, how many women still haven't come forward? I mean, I would venture to say dozens at least, because they know that it will impact their career. They absolutely know. I mean, I know that there are several who had incidents that they wanted to report, but they were waiting to go to the farm because they didn't want to be cut from the farm in an effort of retaliation, which is what happened to Jane Doe in November of 2023. And so a lot of them are going to keep their mouth shut until they feel like they have everything lined up with their career. And so how do you even solve that problem, right? Because you can look at, okay, the mishandling, the offices is set up, the teams to do this report. But how do you get women to come forward in the first place when there's that fear of retaliation? And like I said, they're saying all the right things, but then they're firing the whistleblower, the very first whistleblower for the sexual harassment assault that is groundbreaking. They're firing her. And now they will say, well, you know, there was grounds to fire her. She washed out of the farm. She was cut at mid-boards. You know, the contract is she has to find another office to take her. I mean, you're familiar with this, Mark, within 90 days, right? So what did they do? I mean, there's no doubt in my mind they blackballed her. Who's going to want to take the problem officer who's reported sexual assault and is in the middle of a lawsuit against the agency? So they found, you know, a very clear reason that they could fire her and they could lean on, and nobody can prove otherwise, but you're not going to convince me because I know from the amount of people I've interviewed that she was a stellar officer. And so I find it very hard to believe, first of all, that she got cut from the farm for not being able to write, which is complete and total bullshit. You're not going to convince me that a woman, you know, into her 30s, well into her career, a mid-career hire who has been successful everywhere else she's been, you know, everyone that she's worked for during her interims spoke so highly of her. You're not going to convince me that she got cut from the farm because she couldn't write. I don't believe it. I've seen some case officers writing. I've seen like,
hey, wait a second.
100% spoken as a former analyst. Like that is a bullshit excuse. But listen, they're smart. And so this is the stuff that you have to read between the lines because of course, publicly, they're going to say, you know, we condemn any sort of, that's what they have to say. But then they're firing her. And so I will say, you know, they held and I shouldn't say this, I won't be invited to anything ever again, but they held an internal event for International Women's Day in March 8th, I think. And they had a panel of women and an author there discussing her recent book on women in the CIA. And I was invited to attend, and I was cleared on everything and was planning to go. But then a month before, when Jane Doe was fired, I just said, I'm not going. I can't go. I can't go and sit there in this audience and listen to them pretend that they're supporting women when they've just terminated this very important whistleblower who should have whistleblower protections. And actually, there's something I want to read. So it was passed at the end of the year, the Intelligence Authorization Act. So that includes some of these new standards and procedures. And it actually says there should be appropriate career path protection for all employees involved in an incident resulting in a reported allegation of sexual assault or sexual harassment while an administrative or criminal investigation or review of the allegation is pending. So appropriate career path protection, it should be there. So I 100% agree with you, Mark, that there needs to be congressional oversight because they can't be left to their own devices because they're just going to keep sweeping things under the rug.
So Christina, what I find strange is that, you know, this makes the agency look so bad. And this is the firing of Jane Doe. It just, you know, there was so much publicity behind this. And I just think that, you know, if I was a manager and someone came to me and said, look, this is someone who washed out of the farm, whether justified or not, you know, but hey, we need you to take her as an officer. I would have done it in a second. I mean, this is such a no-brainer for so many different reasons. First of all, there are different career paths, and you know, and so maybe she would have found her calling as a targeter, as a, you know, as an analyst, you know, whatever. So, you know, we put a lot of money into hiring people. So certainly there were some things that we saw. So give her a second chance. But the other piece is, like, from a PR standpoint, this is insane that they ended up terminating her. And then, you know, falling back on this kind of 90-day period that she couldn't find a job, I would have taken her. If someone had come to me, if the director of the CIA said, Mark, I need you to take her in this unit, can you do this? I've said 100%. I would have done it for a variety of reasons. One is because, you know, everyone does deserve a second chance. And perhaps, you know, she can have a very successful career in a different career track. But number two is, good Lord, the negative publicity behind this. I mean, this seems to be almost, you know, negligent on the leadership doing something that just ends up looking terrible.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, she is a Russian speaker, so has a great skill set. I find it hard to believe that no one was really willing to take her unless she was blackballed. I don't know about you, Mark, but I don't remember ever hearing of someone who washed out of the farm but then wasn't able to find somewhere to take that. Like, I've never heard of that. Maybe people fail the farm and decide that they don't want to stay because all they wanted to do was that. But I don't know of anyone. Like, I just don't think that's very common. In fact, I didn't even know about the 90-day thing until this happened. I never even, because I never saw anyone have difficulty finding something after that.
Yeah, the officers who didn't pass my training class ended up staying on and having successful careers. But again, I think, you know, in something like this, this just kind of was as an own goal. I think, you know, one of the things I want to kind of raise, again, it's getting into the weeds a little bit, but it's an office that I thought was always a problem because it actually didn't defend employees. But that's our Office of Equal Employment Opportunity, the EEO office. And, you know, I think what some people don't understand is that that office is actually was always designed to actually protect the agency, not protect the office.
Yeah.
Talk a little about EEO and first of all, what some of the people that you interviewed thought of that office, and then, of course, what kind of reforms have come into place after this all is kind of broken out in the public.
Well, it sounds like from what I've heard from women who have gone to EEO, like over the past 1 to 2 years, is that it's fraught with lots of internal issues that they aren't even equipped to handle these incident reports. But it's interesting because I know that a number of these women have gone to multiple offices to report. And so the EEO angle is particularly interesting in Jane Doe's case because she is an officer with a disability. She's hard of hearing. And so that is something where you would expect to see more support from EEO. But from my understanding, there were some issues, and I'm not privy to the details, with the management there and some just internal. And I think the report alludes to that. But what I was disappointed that was not included in the bill that was passed. There's a section that was in the draft, and then when it later was passed at the end of last year, it was taken out. But they had originally written in a victim and whistleblower counsel who reports directly to the CIA's chief operating officer and maintain independence from the Office of General Counsel for the purpose of providing representation, guidance, and facilitating resources, da, da, da. So I bring that up because just like you said, yeah, you go to an office like EEO, I think some employees might be under the misunderstanding that they're there to protect and support them, but they're not. They're there for the agency, just like HR. I mean, it's any company, right? You go to your HR rep, their number one goal is to protect the company. And that's the same. It's no different at the agency. Of course, they'll protect you as long as your interests are in line with the organization's. But if they're not, like, no, that's not your personal representation. So it's really too bad that was taken out. I hope that it's something they'll continue adding because I do think that there needs to be a safe place for women or to go who report this so that they can have that actual confidential support that's looking out for their interests. But I mean, even then I would probably still be skeptical, but maybe that's the conspiracy in me.
So Christina, one of the things that I've done in retirement is I've spent a lot of time traveling the country and speaking at colleges. It's something that I've really enjoyed doing. It's passing the torch to the next generation. And at a time where, of course, we see, protests roiling college campuses all over the country. And I think there's some people can have some questions about kind of Generation Z, the next generation. I actually always found it invigorating. And now in particular, I'd be talking to a foreign policy class or a class on intelligence studies. But, I think there are really great, young students who want to join the intelligence community. But I will say that not every time. And I probably do these maybe three times a month. I'll go be do a guest lecture. I was just down at University of Virginia, in fact. But often, and in particular, since this report came out, someone's going to ask me, about this. And so what, I guess the question, and so I'm in a strange place, I have to say, because I'm a male officer. And so now I'm speaking on behalf of, how female officers are treated at the agency. But, but young students will ask me, what is going on there? And so the response that I think I've given is to be honest. I can't say everything's fine. I can talk about how things have changed over time, as what I alluded to before, much less overt harassment, but certainly there's issues. But put yourself in my shoes. If you're giving a lecture on national security and someone says, a female a senior at UVA says to you, "Hey, I think I really want to join the CIA. What's going on there? I read this report." What would you say in response? And frankly, I do think it's different for me as a male versus a former female officer in talking about the organization. I think, in fact, it's probably much better answered by someone like yourself, or I'll just throw that out there, my wife as well. My wife was an agency officer too, and she's actually going to talk to a university at the end of this week about female officers' careers in the IC. This is going to come up. What would you say if someone just said to you flat out, "What's up with this report? Is this a place where I'm going to be treated fairly in my career?"
I think this report really symbolizes a reckoning that the agency is dealing with. I think it's been going on for decades, and I think it's finally come to a head. We saw Me Too arrive, in our larger culture years ago, but because the CIA is such an insular culture, it's taken longer to really grab hold there. But now it has, and there is an avenue for women to report their incidents. And there are women who are offering that support. A lot of these movements have actually been grassroots. So a lot of these committees that have started up have been organized by the officers themselves. And so a lot of that support is there. I mentioned that, there hasn't always been a feeling of sisterhood at the agency throughout the decades, but I think we're getting as pretty damn close to it as we ever have. Unfortunately, because women have these shared traumatic experiences. But the plus side of that is that there's an avenue to report. It's been recognized. There's congressional oversight. It's the safest time to join because people are not standing for it because it's been brought to light. I think it's been, swept under the rug for far too long. So I would tell these young women, we need you. We need you for national security. There are parts of the world that view women as invisible. Well, the joke is on them because we are eating their lunch. They might think that women are useless and there's no way they would be doing intelligence. Meanwhile, you know, the woman is collecting foreign intelligence and you know, right under their nose and they have no idea. There are so many ways that we can take advantage and leverage women's talents and abilities, their ability to be empathetic with their assets and build relationships. Of course, there are unique parts to being a woman and meeting with an asset. There's multiple issues here, right? Because it's the incidents that happen within the building with your own colleagues. But also, I think it's important to talk about what it's like in the field. You're usually meeting one-on-one with an asset. And as a woman, oftentimes that asset is a man. And so I experienced some of this myself. And then a number of the women I've interviewed also talk about what they have done in the field in particular to make sure that their intentions are known, right? So there are these, some of these things that women just do. But what I would say to these new young women coming in is that the goal is that there are going to be trainings in place, that women aren't going to have to figure these things out on the job and figure out, okay, the next time I have a hotel meeting with an asset, I want to make sure the bed is not in sight. Or the next time I have a meeting, I'm going to dress like, you know, really horrible and, you know, wear a ball cap and look, you know, the fact that women even have to think about these things is just absolutely ridiculous, but that's the world. And so these are the things that some women have been doing to protect themselves. But I know that there's some discussion about adding that type of training so that women are prepared for these scenarios.
I think that's really important too. I mean, I think back to so many times in my career. So a female case officer would come back from an operational meeting and they would say, if I was a manager in the field, and they would say, I was hit on in this meeting and this is, you know, and this is how I handled it. And then the question was always, should we write this up in the operational cable? Like, what's the perception going to be like at headquarters? And first of all, I thought that was, you know, it's too bad that's the climate that we were in, because obviously if you write it up, it means the female officer did something wrong to bring that on, which is utterly ludicrous. And I would argue that you have to write that up because maybe that's a behavioral trend in the agent who later on someone else is going to have to deal with.
Such a great point.
And so, I'll end this segment before we get to the kind of the subscriber part of the show. And I think I've told you this before, is, you know, my wife and I were both posted to a Middle Eastern country, and she was out on a surveillance detection route and just ran across a surveillance net just by chance. It was unlucky. And we had a penetration of the service. And so we got the report that they made about her, about my wife, Cynthia. And they said, well, we saw Cynthia Sadi on an operational act, right? Of course, she can't be the spy. So let's put full-time surveillance on Mark. And I had 6 months of bumper lock surveillance after that. And I was like, hey, what the F? And and Cynthia was surveillance free. And as you said, ate their lunch. But that was because of misogynistic behavior on the part of the adversary's intelligence service. I love that story. I tell that all the time in these college talks, too. Again, that's why I would argue that diversity is actually, you know, our super fuel. That it's such a powerful weapon we have in terms of beating our adversaries, particularly in the Middle East. But I thought that story was funny. And so I had this blanket surveillance all the time. Like, hey, thanks a lot.
That's a great one. I didn't know that story. I mean, you saw that happening, I mean, in the 70s with Marty Peterson in Moscow. And you would think that after that happened, you know, she was the first woman working operationally in Moscow at the time. And, you know, obviously was later PNG'd. But it had nothing to do with her, right? Like they did, it was, we found out years later that it was someone else who had shared her name or shared that the asset had been compromised, but it wasn't her. It had nothing to do with the fact that she was a woman. But of course, a lot of the questions immediately were, oh, you must have missed surveillance. Like, you know, like she wasn't good. She didn't see them. It had nothing to do with her. But you would think that they would have learned, you know, to look at women after that. But sometimes misogyny is very powerful.
Yeah, we're gonna beat them. It was awesome. I love that story. And I mean, I have so many kind of stories. I got to be careful on what I can tell here. One female case officer I had it in one location. She actually was on the way to meet a penetration of the host government. She actually was hit by a car, broke her hip. She went to the meeting, didn't even call that night, came into the office the next day. And then we had medevac her right out of that place. Pretty badass story. And I didn't think of the mail case. I thought of myself. I was like, God damn, I think I probably would have called someone and gotten immediate medical attention. She said, no, I'm protecting my cover. Broke her hip and spent weeks recovering, in Europe.
It doesn't surprise me. There's an amazing woman I profile in my book who actually was doing a tour in the war zone and had tripped on the stairs in the station and had some back issues and ended up having to go back to the US to get an MRI on her back. When they find out she has like a herniated disc, okay, that's what she expected. But they also say, we see a shadow on your kidney and it doesn't look good. Like this is probably cancer. And she says, I'm only like 2 months into my 1 year tour. Like, how fast do you think this cancer is going to grow? And they say, well, I mean, it should be slow growing, but like, are you hearing me? Like, you have cancer. And she goes back to the war zone and finishes out her tour. She's such a badass. Like, she's this amazing woman that I get to tell her whole story in the book. And anyway, she ends up coming back from the tour and the cancer grew a lot faster than they had predicted and ended up losing a kidney, but thankfully was okay. But that's the kind of commitment, right? I mean, there was no stopping her. She was going to go back and finish that tour. She was not going short a tour for a little thing like cancer.
All right. Well, this is a perfect teaser for the last 10 minutes of the show. So this is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of this podcast and to all of our other shows in full, just go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $7 a month and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.